fire-breathing chimera with the heads of a snake, lion, and she-goat. A one-eyed cannibal. Venomous women whose gaze turns viewers into stone. A monster with 100 snake heads for his shoulder, whose name is still used today for typhoon. Those are just a few of the monsters from ancient Greece and Rome. What do we learn not only about the ancient world, but also about ourselves from a look at monsters of antiquity? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest this hour is William Brockless, professor of classics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Homeric Imagery and the Natural Environment. Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Well, let's start by this question of monsters themselves. It seems there's monsters everywhere, on film, in any mythology, all kinds of what is it about monsters that fascinates us?
That's a very interesting question, and one that sadly people have been failing to address until quite recently. Partly consigned monsters to the realm of the childish, so something that wasn't proper for serious study, and on the other side of things, also just took monsters for granted as something so common in our imaginary. As I say, more recently, people have been trying to explore why we're so fascinated with monsters, what they contribute to our depiction of the human condition. And I'd like to pick up on three key areas that are essential to that. Monsters are what we are not. They're mixtures of all sorts of different types of being in the one body with all sorts of different behaviours exhibited. Monsters are where we are not. Typically, they're banished to exotic islands or outer space or what have you. And finally, monsters are who we are not, if we might think there of monstrous individuals such as the psychopath, which is a big part of the modern discourse of monsters. And in combination, all these different facets of monsters add up to a way of defining human beings. These are a key way in which we get to explore our nature.
Listeners by now will have picked up on the fact from your British accent that you are British. I just have a personal question. What drew you for your field of studies to ancient Greek and Roman studies, and in particular right now, projects that are looking at monsters? You could be doing Shakespeare and Keats and Charles Dickens and so on, but this ancient Greek and Roman world, what for you is the pull?
I think a lot of it dates back to when I was really quite young, and I was given the opportunity, as I think a lot of people are at quite a young age, to engage with ancient Greek myths. And some of the very first that I was able to engage with were stories such as those of Perseus and how he encounters Medusa. And that just fascinated me from there on. It's possibly, I'm not sure, an interest in the ancient world is one that everybody shares. That may just be something that's particular to particular people. I would, though, say that there's plenty of justification for such an interest because there are such fascinating stories from the ancient world and so many fascinating monsters. And as I've said, monsters are such a key part of how we explore who we are that I think it's reasonably natural that we would we would find ancient monsters fascinating also.
You mentioned as one of your three areas what monsters are, that they're what we're not, and that they often combine human form with something else. Can you tell us about some of those?
Okay, one of the key texts for this, we can look at Hesiod's Theogony. This is a very, very old Greek poem that basically explores how the gods came to be, the different generations of the gods, and winds up with Zeus's establishment of supremacy in the cosmos. And as we all know, Zeus is in charge of the cosmos now. So that's the last point in the poem. And in the course of the poem, there are a number of instances in which monsters are generated. Now, the monsters aren't strictly part of the divine succession, which starts off with sort of elemental beings such as the earth, the sky, goes on to the Titans, then on to the Olympian gods. But there are glimpses of how things could have been and how things could have gone off in a much less orderly direction, with firstly a long account of the monsters that were the offspring of the union of Phorcys and Cato, who were sort of beings connected with the sea. And those include, for instance, the Chimera, who's got a really weird mixture of things in her body. She's a mixture of a snake, a lion, and a she-goat. So it's a really sort of incongruous there, and you'd expect that the lion would want to eat the she-goat, but apparently that doesn't happen. And this all culminates in Zeus's last opponent, Typhoeus, the most chaotic being in the universe of the Theogony, and also Zeus's last opponent. And this is where it could have all gone wrong, and Typhoeus could have been in charge. I could just read you a little description of Typhoeus there, which gives you a sense not only of his physical disorder, but also of his sonic disorder. Which is important in the context of a poem like the Theogony, which was sung and would have sounded beautiful. Typhoeus, definitely not so beautiful in his sound. So here we go. From his shoulders, there were 100 heads of a snake, a terrible dragon's, licking with dark tongues. And on his prodigious heads, fire sparkled from his eyes under the eyebrows. And from all of his head, fire burned as he glared. And there were voices in all his terrible heads, sending forth all kinds of sounds, inconceivable. For sometimes they would utter sounds as though for the gods to understand. And at other times, the sound of a loud bellowing, majestic bull, unstoppable in his strength. At other times, that of a lion with a ruthless spirit. At other times, like young dogs, a wonder to hear. And at other times, he hissed, and the high mountains echoed from below.
That's quite a creature. Now, the date that Hesiod is writing this is roughly...
Round about 700 BC. One of the oldest poems of the Greek tradition alongside the Homeric poems.
And is he repeating or describing here a figure that would have been well known in ancient Greece, and he's just putting it into written form?
In part, he's drawing on wider traditions of the ancient Eastern Mediterranean, that where there were tales of such monsters in traditions such as the Babylonian tradition, which were absorbed into Greek poems such as the Theogony. The big question then comes, how innovative is he being in bringing such tales into the Greek tradition? Is it the case that there'd be many generations of Greek poets working with these sort of things up to that point? Some people think that's the case. Other people, that these had been recent imports owing to recent contacts with the Near East, greater trade happening in the 8th century BCE, that sort of thing, and an openness to these representations of monsters that you firstly get in poems such as the Theogony, and then in Greek art in the 7th century BCE, monsters become a big thing in Greek art. The problem is, basically, once you get back beyond Hesiod, there's very little evidence for that we could point to from the Greek tradition. So does that mean that there wasn't anything, or just that we've lost the evidence? Very difficult to say.
So with a figure like this, and you'll have to tell us how his name becomes Typhoon, that we use today still, but with a figure like this who's got the 100 heads of a snake and different kinds of animals and all the, you know, snake tail, I don't know what all, lion and bull and different sounds, what kind of reason would there be? What kind of, I don't know, what need did it fulfill to have a monster of this sort?
So within the context of this particular poem and also its performance context, that's what we got to think of as well, not just the words on the page, but the performance context, then we can think in terms of monsters being what we are not, as I was saying earlier. So firstly, Typhoeus, unlike human beings who just have human bodies with human parts. Typhoeus has all sorts of different body parts. And of course, that also contrasts with the Olympian gods who are anthropomorphic, so they look like human beings as well. Typhoeus, not so. So that helps to define the body and the body of the people in the audience, for one thing. Also, the way he mixes sounds, as I was saying, is important in the context of a Greek poem that was sung. And there's a lot of emphasis in the Theogony on musical sound. The poem opens with the meeting of Hesiod with the Muses on Mount Helicon, which is a rather bold claim. This was how he became a singer. He was given the gift of song on Mount Helicon. And that is a beautiful, smooth sound and an orderly sound. Typhoeus, very, very different. So he's the direct opposite of the kind of orderly musical sound that people were hearing in the audience at the time. And in that way helps to define another aspect of the human experience, the human song.
So we look at a monster to help us figure out what we are as opposed to something else. But if you look around with all the mythological ones that seem to be a fusion of animals and people, where you've got somebody, well, you know, where you've got winged women, aren't the harpies and furies, aren't they like winged bird women or something? And there's others where it might have like the bottom of a horse and then the head of a person. What would be a sort of reason behind these fusions between people and animals? Is it that we're exploring how we are an animal, how we are sort of related to beasts, or is it fantasizing that we could fly? What do you see? If you look at all the different chimeras, I guess, all the different human-animal figures that are in ancient Greek and Roman myth, is there something that helps to explain why we seem to keep doing this?
That's a very interesting question. In the context of the Theogony is quite different from what we might expect, because the Theogony doesn't like so much to mix human with other forms. Even when you look at figures like the Gorgon in the Theogony, the three Gorgon sisters are described as being weird because one of them is immortal. One of them is mortal and the other two are immortal. So that's a kind of strange mixture. But there's no sense in which they have snake heads or what have you in that poem. But yes, as you rightly say, in the wider Greek tradition, you do have depictions of monstrous figures such as the harpies, and you also get monstrous figures who are regarded as something closer to the gods as well. Maybe not full on gods, but figures like Pan, who mixes the characteristics of a goat with the characteristics of a human, and in those respects, I think we're moving over to a different sort of use of monsters, where it's not simply defining ourselves against monsters, but maybe exploring a bit more about what humans are like when you sort of scratch away the sort of civilized surface. So it's what civilized humans are not, or at least humans when they're trying to act civilized, when we're trying to put across that appearance. But you certainly have an idea of the intersection of the human and the wild in figures like Pan. There's also possibly when you look at figures like the harpies, but people have done explorations of those in terms of not merely how ancient people in general were thinking about themselves and their own sort of hidden uncivilized characteristics and that sort of thing. But more specifically, and we've got to remember that the vast, vast majority of our sources are created by men, mm-hmm. that these were ways for Greek men to think about and express their fears of women. And so these threatening figures, such as the harpies, are very possibly monsterized versions of women from that sort of male perspective in this very, very divided patriarchal society that we were talking about then.
There seem to be a lot of deadly women in Greek and ancient writing, ones that seduce men and then destroy them in some way. So wouldn't it be true also, though, that I assume this comes up in the Theogony, that Zeus and some of the other gods are a bit monstrous themselves in their behavior, and certainly they would be charged with sexual harassment these days.
Yeah, yeah. So, and this is one of the things people notice very often in the Theogony, that, yeah, people like, not people, but beings like Typhoeus are very obviously monstrous in their forms and their behavior, that sort of thing. But the generations of the gods also exhibit various monstrous actions. Firstly, in the first generation of the gods, you have heaven and earth, who are the parents of the Titans, it's not made explicit in the Theogony how this is happening, but heaven basically, who's the male character, stops the earth giving birth. So the earth just becomes full up with children, and the earth being the female equivalent, suffers immeasurably because of that. In the next generation, you have one of their sons, Kronos, who, in order to avoid being displaced by one of his sons, decides to swallow all of his children immediately they are born. And Zeus as well not only defeats figures such as Typhoeus in a really quite violent fashion, he also swallows his first wife, who goes by the name of Mertis or Cunning. Possibly the idea is there that he sort of soaks up this this force associated with female characters in the Theogony of intelligence that up to that stage that the male gods have been really quite brutish and just relying on their own violence, and from that point on Zeus can at least combine his violent tendencies with some wiser ways. But in order to do that, he commits this very violent act of swallowing his wife.
So I guess that kind of proves my point that the monsters are not limited to the monsters, in a sense that, you know, the gods exhibit monstrous behavior as well. Can you tell the story of Typhoeus? You know, what does he do with his monstrosity and what happens to him?
It's a very interesting story in the Theogony because it's one of many places where the Theogony seems to leave gaps, and you have to work out why this is the case. First of all, this isn't the first appearance of Typhoeus in the Theogony. The lines that I read earlier were from lines 824 to 835, which is near the end of the poem. But Typhoeus actually appears nearer the start, somewhere in the 300s, where he is the mate of the monstrous Echidna. So that's a bit puzzling because it seems that later on in the poem, immediately he comes onto the earth, immediately he's born, he goes to face Zeus. And towards the end of the poem, that seems to be immediately what happens. He appears and is this crazy chaotic being, and Zeus has to face him down, and they have this huge battle causes this huge conflagration on Earth. Zeus eventually defeats him with his characteristic weapon, the thunderbolt, and because you can't really kill a divine character like Typhoeus, he has to imprison him somewhere. Zeus had imprisoned the Titans in the very depths of the underworld in Tartarus. Typhoeus, he decides to stop up under a mountain. So he's shut up under a mountain, but there's still this story, and this is one of the few places in the Theogony where humans come into the story. It's mostly about the gods. There's a mention of how Typhoeus is still active, blowing chaotic winds over the earth, and that's the where we get the typhoon wind from. In other traditions, there's a poem by Pindar which which describes Typhoeus trapped below Mount Etna, and of course Mount Etna is a volcano, and he's spewing out flames and also messing with things on Earth that way. So Zeus, it seems, has managed to stop the immediate threat to himself, but Typhoeus is still causing a bit of mischief on Earth.
So is there a kind of just-so story quality to some of the monsters that if you take natural disasters like typhoons or volcanoes, if you are trying to explain these natural calamities of all kinds, that monsters have a way of reflecting that or explaining it?
I think actually Typhoeus is a little bit of an exception in that regard. Other natural disasters, it's usually Poseidon who's to blame for various natural disasters connected with the sea and also connected with earthquakes, that sort of thing. However, when we're talking about natural affliction, well, I mean, of course, the ultimate affliction being death, monsters are closely associated with the death of humans in the Greek tradition. In the Homeric underworld, the dead who like a lot of monstrous characters in the Odyssey, for instance, are placed at the end of the earth. They're in the company of monsters. There are two guardians of the underworld, both monsters, to make sure that nobody living gets into the underworld. They have the head of Medusa in the underworld, who can take away people's lives if they're trying to slip in while still alive. And on the other way, Cerberus, the three-headed dog, is waiting in order to devour you if you try and escape from the underworld. So in that way, there seems to be some sort of conception that death is something monstrous, that it's so completely other from the experience of the living human, that it should be associated with monsters in this way.
One of the monsters that many people have heard about from the Odyssey would be the Cyclops with his giant eye, and we're going to look at that next on University of the Year.
When we had reached the place, which lay close at hand, there on the land's edge close by the sea, we saw a high cave, roofed over with laurels, and there many flocks, sheep and goats alike, were penned at night. Round about it a high courtyard was built with stones set deep in the earth, and with tall pines and high-crested oaks. There a monstrous man spent his nights, who shepherded his flocks alone and afar, and did not mingle with others, but lived apart, obedient to no law. For he was created a monstrous marvel, and was not like a man that lives by bread, but like a wooded peak of lofty mountains, which stands out to view alone apart from the rest.
As a description of the Cyclops from Homer's Odyssey, I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Will Brockless. We are talking about monsters of antiquity. So in this case, we're following Odysseus and his journeys far away. Tell us about how monsters fit into the story of the Odyssey.
So monsters in the Odyssey are largely associated with Odysseus's travels and the way that he describes those travels in books 9 to 12. When he's in the court of the Phaeacians, he spends quite a lot of time describing what he's been experiencing on his travels, on his attempts to get home from the Trojan War to his home of Ithaca. And he encounters such beings as Scylla with her dog's heads, the Sirens, which at least in later Greek tradition were mixtures of human and bird-like form, and as we were mentioning earlier, the dead and the monstrous Gorgon in the Land of the Dead. This particular tale of the Cyclops is the first major exploration of monstrosity in the Odyssey, and so is very important for setting the parameters for the poem's exploration of monsters. In the poem, in the lines that we were just looking at, you do have this focus on the monstrous size of the Cyclops, and also his uncivilized behavior, that he's not one who mingles with others, he doesn't have any laws, and in the way that he lives by himself, Odysseus, who's narrating these lines, he sees fit to assimilate him to the very landscape that so far is he from making the grade as a human being, that he seems more like a mountain peak than a human being.
And he's living in a cave.
He's living in a cave, so it's a very uncivilized behavior. And it soon becomes clear that this isn't where the uncivilized behavior ends, because of course, once Odysseus enters his cave, and of course, it's a bit cheeky behaviour because he doesn't ask permission for this, but he's hoping to try and get a gift from the Cyclops, because you're supposed to give gifts to guests, and so he appeals to the Cyclops and says, "Hey, you've heard of Zeus, and Zeus protects guests, so can you give us a gift?" And the Cyclops responds by eating two of Odysseus's companions in the following way. "The Cyclops sprang up and laid his hands upon my comrades. Two of them together he seized and dashed to the earth like puppies, and their brains flowed forth upon the ground and wetted the earth. Then he cut them limb from limb and made ready his supper and ate them like a mountain-nurtured lion, leaving nothing, ate the entrails and the flesh and the bones and marrow."
Not much of a host.
No, not much of a host. It, basically, the absolute opposite of what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to not only provide gifts, you're also supposed to provide dinner to your guests, even before they introduce themselves. That's the rules in this particular world. But instead, the Cyclops sees fit to make his meal out of his guests.
What do you make of the fact that the Cyclops has one giant eye?
What I make of it is probably a little different from what the what Homer and his audience necessarily made of it, because the poet Homer or the tradition of poets associated with Homeric poetry, they didn't place fantastic emphasis on the single eye. He must have a single eye because Odysseus is able to blind him. But there's much more emphasis on his on uncivilized behavior, and that is of interest also when we get towards the end of the episode, when Odysseus's own rather violent behaviour is given emphasis, and in that way complements the earlier depiction of the Cyclops. And I'll just read a little bit further from Odysseus's behaviour later in the episode. "They took the stake of olive wood, sharp at the point, and thrust it into his eye, while I, throwing my weight upon it from above, whirled it round as a man bores a ship's timber with a drill, while those below kept it spinning with the strap, which they lay hold of by either end, and the drill runs unceasingly. Even so, we took the fiery pointed stake and whirled it around in his eye, and the blood flowed round it as all hot as it was. His eyelids above and below, and his brows were all singed by the flame from the burning eyeball, and its roots crackled in the fire. And as when a smith dips a great axe or an adze in cold water to temper it and it makes a great hissing, from this becomes the strength of iron. So did his eye hiss around the stake of olive wood. Terribly then did he cry aloud, and the rock ran around. And we, seized with terror, shrank back, while he wrenched from his eye the stake, all befouled with blood.
You almost start to feel sorry for the Cyclops. That's a horrible image of gouging out his eye.
Yeah, it's a very strange image as well, in that it includes imagery of civilization, of making a ship's timber, and also of tempering iron in cold water. But at the same time, there's something rather chilling about that, the combination of that with the extremely violent activity that Odysseus and his men, who were the 'they' in the lines, what they carry out here, and this sort of theme of a more sympathetic view of the Cyclops continues a little later when Odysseus and his men make their escape from the cave. Odysseus, because he's the greatest hero, so he's the heaviest, so he has to be below the most impressive ram, and it seems that the Cyclops has a very tender relationship with the ram, and talks to the ram as the ram is exiting with Odysseus underneath it, and whether the ram had stayed behind specially because the ram felt sorry for the Cyclops with his affliction, having been blinded by Odysseus, whereas normally the ram would stride out in front of all the rest of them. So, this becomes quite puzzling in terms of our sympathies by the end of it. And also, if we're going to accuse the Cyclops of monstrous behaviour and his cannibalism, to what extent can we absolve Odysseus and his men of monstrous behaviour in this instance? And this is a theme that we do get in a number of Greek texts. To what extent are those who do battle with monsters exhibiting monstrous behaviours?
Well, I was wondering too, is one explanation for the number of, you know, incredible monsters that it sets up the hero? In other words, for example, I think you mentioned Cerberus, the three-headed dog. And I think Hercules kills Cerberus, right? So it's more impressive if you can say I killed a three-headed dog than if it's just a regular dog. And with Odysseus, if you're trying to establish him as the hero of the Odyssey, then if you've got a one-eyed monster that's a cannibal, again, it sets up the hero. Same with the Minotaur or these other ones. Is part of what we're doing when we see fantastical, horrific monsters, it's just an excuse for the poet to pull forward the heroic qualities of the antagonist?
In some cases, very much so, and it depends what the poet decides to emphasise in the particular tale. In the account from the Odyssey that we were just reading, there are so many, frankly, disgusting details in the description of Odysseus's own actions that he comes to seem rather less heroic. Often where the hero comes across as more unproblematically heroic is when we have, yeah, if we, for instance, we think of Hercules or Heracles in the Greek tradition, some of the accounts of his exploits are largely just lists of his achievements, so you're not invited to sympathise with the monsters. It's more a case of look how impressive that the number of feats that he achieved, the peculiar beings that he encountered. So the sympathies there aren't explored so much. However, even in his case, there are instances where his heroic status becomes rather more problematized. For instance, in Euripides' play, The Madness of Heracles, there he kills his wife and his children shortly after completing his labours. It's not quite as simple as that, because Hera, who really has it in for Heracles, sends the goddess Madness to instill him with the madness that causes him to carry out this terrible crime. But even so, this does unsettle the picture a bit of this idealized hero.
What about in the case of Theseus?
Yeah, I mean, he's also an interesting case who's recently been explored by a colleague of mine, Debbie Felton, who's at UMass Amherst. And she's been looking at possible figures of the serial killer in the ancient world. Usually, people tend to act a bit surprised when we use that term of the ancient world, because for some reason we think it must be a peculiarly modern phenomenon. But she has been able to point to examples that really do seem to fit pretty well into that category. That in the case of Theseus, I mean, basically he's the great Athenian hero and the great civilizing Athenian hero. And so if he was going to be a proper hero, he had to have labors like those of Heracles, or at least a number of labors that could go some way to comparing with the other great hero. What's interesting about the characters that he faces is that firstly, they tend to be fully human in form. And secondly, they exhibit repetitive, monstrous behaviors. Probably the most famous one from the modern standpoint is Procrustes, giving us our modern adjective Procrustean, and that comes from the story of Procrustes, that basically he's an innkeeper, and not an innkeeper you'd want to spend the night with, because he has just one bed, and he's very pernickety about the people who use this bed, that you have to fit his bed perfectly. I mean, if you're lucky enough that you're the perfect size, no problem, but if you're slightly too long, he saws your feet off. If you're not long enough, he'll stretch you out and until you fit it. And somehow or other, this manages to kill the occupant of the bed, presumably lets them bleed out or something horrible like that. So Theseus comes along and he says, right, I'm not having any of this. Theseus deliberately takes the difficult route to Athens when he first comes to Athens, and goes through the countryside and passes by Procrustes' inn and says, OK, Procrustes, enough of this. I'm going to give you a taste of your own medicine, and puts him on the bed and forces him to fit it and finishes him off. But on the other side of things, when we're talking about the balance, when we were earlier talking about the balance between the possibly monstrous behaviour of the hero and that of the so-called monster, Theseus, whereas all these different categories have their own repetitive, one might say, modus operandi, like a serial killer, Theseus kind of has his own, because every single one he encounters, he kills using the same technique that particular monstrous individual used against their victims. So again, we end up with a rather troubled sense of who is heroic here. And I could just read a couple of lines from the 5th century poet Bacchylides, who's praising Theseus for the most part, but still, yeah, it's a complicated portrayal here. He lists the achievements of Theseus, but there's also a sense of he's a really frightening character who's turning up in Athens. A herald came just now, having completed on foot the long journey from the Isthmus, and he tells of indescribable deeds on the part of a strong man. He has slain the mighty Sinis, who was foremost of mortals in strength, offspring of Cronus' son, the earthshaker, the loosener. And he has killed the man-killing sow in the glens of Cremion, and wicked Skyron too, and he has put an end to the wrestling school of Cercyon, and Procrustes has dropped the mighty hammer of Polypemon, having met a better man than himself. I'm afraid how all this will end.
So he's afraid of what Theseus may do?
Yes, and this is the problem with the hero, that these are These are not only civilizing characters, but they're also characters with such prodigious strength and such prodigious abilities that they have the potential to destabilize all the order that they encounter as well, at the same time as dealing with disorderly characters in the world.
So you're saying that rather than just looking at a monster, we can look at the capability within anyone to behave in a monstrous fashion.
That's possibly one of the lessons we could take away from these sort of stories, and that Theseus maybe could represent his descendants in Athens. These are sort of potentially monstrous characteristics that they had within themselves.
We're going to look at werewolves, witches, and also some modern monsters when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The king himself flies in terror and, gaining the silent fields, howls aloud, attempting in vain to speak. His mouth of itself gathers foam, and with his accustomed greed for blood, he turns against the sheep, delighting still in slaughter. His garments change to shaggy hair, his arms to legs. He turns into a wolf, and yet retains some traces of his former shape. There is the same grey hair, the same fierce face, the same gleaming eyes, the same picture of beastly savagery.
That's from Ovid, an example of a werewolf. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Will Brockless, and we're talking about monsters of antiquity. So we still have werewolves, very popular today. What's happening in that scene that you just read?
Basically, Jupiter, the king of the gods, in Ovid's Metamorphoses, this is very near the beginning of the poem, he has to explain to his fellow gods the rationale behind his plan to annihilate the human race. And so Jupiter comes along and says, "Hey, I went roaming the earth, and I met this guy Lycaon, and I stayed at his house. And do you know what he did? He served up another human being to me as the meal." And Jupiter, in response to that, gives Lycaon an appearance appropriate to his behaviour, that he becomes a wolf, he turns into a wolf. And there are other stories of werewolves in the ancient tradition. It seems that this particular one is a bit unlike modern werewolves in that it doesn't look like there's any chance that Lycaon is ever going to turn back into a human being. There are others. There's a story, for instance, in the Roman novelist Petronius, where there's a soldier who at night turns into a wolf and attacks sheep and all that sort of thing. And of course, yeah, these are stories that we have inherited and developed these days. We can think only of the Twilight Saga in that regard. Still terrifically popular stories, possibly, and this connects to something we were saying earlier, pictures and explorations of the wilder, hidden side of human beings that maybe is constrained, papered over by the more civilized aspects that we like to present to the world.
So we have this civilized facade, but there's a werewolf, a wolf underneath that's just longing to come out.
Yeah. Another way to look at it would be as a way to exclude beings or peoples who we don't see as quite making the civilized standard. Here Lycaon doesn't meet the sort of civilized behaviors that are expected of him. And so if you want a different way of looking at it, then maybe Ovid's audience can say, oh, well, at least we're not like that. At least we're more civilized than Lycaon. I can understand why Jupiter was so angry with people at that stage, but the current generation of humanity has certainly improved in comparison with that.
You mentioned before that because most of the writers in ancient Greece and Rome were men, that there are a lot of sort of deadly women. Can you say something about witches?
Sure. Witches, as to a large extent these days, were an important part of the ancient imaginary. One of the most striking depictions of witches actually comes from later in the tradition. I mean, we certainly have figures like Circe from Homer and a number of other figures like Medea. We could just focus on this passage from Lucan's Pharsalia, which was from the first century AD. Lucan, a poet writing under the Emperor Nero, who, on one level, he is providing a monsterized depiction of the female from a male perspective. There are other elements to it that we might hit up as well in a second. But here's just a description of the sort of thing that Erichtho gets up to in her spare time. The witch eagerly vents her rage on all the limbs of a corpse, thrusting her fingers into the eyes, scooping out gleefully the stiffened eyeballs, and gnawing the yellow nails of the withered hand. She breaks with her teeth the fatal noose and mangles the carcass that dangles on the gallows and scrapes the cross of the criminal. She tears away the rain-beaten flesh and the bones calcined by exposure to the sun. She purloins the nails that pierce the hands, the clotted filth, and the black humour of corruption that oozes over all the limbs. And when a muscle resists her teeth, she hangs her weight upon it. Often, too, when a kinsman is buried, the dreadful witch hangs over the loved body. While kissing it, she mutilates the head and opens the closed mouth with her teeth. Then, biting the tip of the tongue that lies motionless in the dry throat, she pours inarticulate sound into the cold lips and sends a message of mysterious horror down to the shades of hell.
That's pretty gruesome.
It is, and one way of looking at it is, as you were suggesting, that this is, people have read these sort of images of witches as images of what it would be like if women were to be independent from the constraints of society and the horrible things that would result in that sort of thing from this deeply patriarchal perspective that you have in the ancient world. It's not the only way that these sort of images have been read. For instance, the critic Dennis Feeney has a rather more sort of universalizing reading of the scene. We've got to bear in mind that, so I didn't set the context for this, that this is actually from an episode just before the decisive battle of the civil war between Caesar and Pompey and that has thrown the Roman world into disorder. So on one side, that's what Lucan's writing about, this world of war. On the other side, he's also writing under the Emperor Nero and all that.
Monstrous enough.
And all that entails. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So Feeney sees this more as a depiction of the monstrosity that arises in that sort of society. I could just quote his words from Gods in Epic. The breathtakingly repulsive necromancy scene, Lucan's most intense imagining of orders collapse into evil and pain, has alienated many readers. Those who find its horror too powerful should take every step they can to avoid living under a dictatorship.
And that makes me think of some modern monsters coming out of nuclear holocaust, coming out of all kinds of modern disasters and fears. Can you talk about kind of shifting it now to our 20th century, 21st century, kind of where you see things today that kind of remind you of these ancient Greek and Roman tales?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of similar things, themes that are hit up in modern depictions. As you mentioned, for instance, the association of nuclear weaponry, for instance, with monstrosity, which lay behind the Godzilla films and the very first one, film Gojira from Japan in the 50s, which was following the nuclear test on Bikini Atoll. And in that way, exploring the potentially monstrous powers that human beings suddenly had with this access to nuclear, the nuclear world, and Godzilla being a film about how such power, such monstrous power, destroys the natural order. That it sort of wakes up this kind of dinosaur figure who's been peacefully sleeping on the seabed all this time, and his rampage against this city is caused by the use of this terrible weapon. So we got a sense of monstrous actions within the world that we see around us. There's also some other themes that they hit up in modern films that resemble these themes in ancient depictions. For instance, we're still exploring in a metaphorical sense the monstrous beings that you might find at the very edges of the cosmos, that these sort of depictions of monsters in sci-fi movies are very prevalent these days. When you think of the Alien franchise, for instance, in the ancient world generally, with the exception of Lucian's A True Story, which is about a journey to the moon, the depictions of monsters are monsters on the edge of the earth, but it's a similar sort of idea of monsters being where we are not and what we are not in terms of these really strange beings. We've also, and we were talking a bit about monstrous behaviours, psychopathic behaviours earlier on. The Cyclops and Odysseus' response to the Cyclops. We've had Theseus' response to the apparently serial killer types that he meets. And in a lot of modern films as well, there are explorations of the monstrous psychology. And also we've for instance, just one example that springs to mind, the film Carrie, that's from the Stephen King novel, which, associated with one of the things we've pointed up, Stephen King himself describes as an expression of his own fear of women. Mm-hmm. In his general reflections on trying to be brutally honest with himself in that way, so possibly an intersection there with these depictions of figures such as Erichtho from the ancient world.
So, do we need monsters?
It seems, well, in strictly logical terms, I mean, if we wanted to define who we are, who we should be in civilized terms, all that sort of thing. I mean, if we wanted to write fiction about such things, I mean, we could take the sort of line that I suspect Plato would want us to take, where we simply explore perfect heroic types, perfectly just types, and all that sort of thing, and that all our favourite characters would be like Atticus Finch, and not like Boo Radley. But it does seem that we are perennially fascinated with monsters at the same time as using them in order to define ourselves. That there's something within us that seems to need monsters.
My guest has been Will Brockless. We've been talking about monsters of antiquity. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east, the master bedroom where the vampires feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did